From KIOS in Omaha, you're listening to Riverside Chats. I'm Tom Knobloch, and today I'm talking with Congressman Don Bacon.
James Madison designed a system that was hard to work, and he wanted more power at the state and local level. Article 1, Section 8, has very defined duties of Congress, and the intention was the states and the local governments would pick up more. And so I think we've tried to take on too much at the federal level, and we have an unwieldy government. It makes it very hard to be agile. The real intent here is to allow more power at the state and local level, and I think it's something that we're paying for right now. We've consolidated too much power at the top.
We're talking about political dysfunction, Donald Trump's influence over the Republican Party, and Bacon's pitch for 2024. Stay tuned for the conversation after this break. Next time on The Entertainment, we're looking at the legacy of the last big-budget studio parody, Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story.
It parodied its subject so well that it has become inextricable with its subject. The further we get from Walk Hard, the more all biopics will trend toward Walk Hard. The arc of history trends only toward Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox Story.
Listen Saturday at 5 p.m. on 91.5 FM, KIOS, Omaha Public Radio, and PRX. Welcome to Riverside Chats. I'm Tom Knobloch. Don Bacon has represented Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District since 2017. He's running again in a world that has seen all sorts of major shifts. The presidency of Donald Trump, the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the attempted insurrection on January 6, 2020, following the presidential election of Joe Biden, and any number of international incidents. Today he's discussing running for office in a cynical media landscape and the issues on his mind as he makes his pitch for 2024. Here is our conversation. So we are recording this on January 4th, and it's not lost on me that that's almost an anniversary of January 6th. And the way January 6th is talked about in the news is often in these sort of big sensationalistic headlines. I don't often hear the actual accounts of people as they were going through it or what they think about it now outside of kind of like, here's the big story we need to tell about it. So I wonder if maybe we could start there. What was that day like? It must have been difficult.
It was. I was going to be in the chamber that day to listen to the debate. I promised constituents that I would listen because I was planning on voting to certify, but I had folks who wanted me to vote no to certification. They said, well, please listen to the both sides of the case, and I said I would. Mm-hmm. But Speaker Pelosi limited us to 20 people aside because of COVID. And so I just thought, okay, I'll watch it back in the office. So I went back to the office, and I was getting texts from the security saying there's a pipe bomb outside, do not go outside. And then there's violence, or they didn't use those words, but there's outside the doors, there's violence going on, do not leave the building. And then it was lock your door, do not let anybody in. And as all that was going on, I was watching the debate, and all of a sudden I saw people running in the chamber on the TV, and I realized that the protesters had penetrated the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I realized just how bad it was. The thing that strikes me is there's two different narratives. You have the, I don't even want to call it the Democrat narrative, the Republican narrative, because I'm a Republican who doesn't like what happened that day. So, but one narrative is total violence, insurrection. And there surely was. There's 140 people that were injured, right? Mm-hmm. But on the other narrative, they'll show the open doors where people are walking in and the police letting in. And that also happened. And my point being is both of them are true, but both sides, there was both going on. And why was that? Well, the leadership of the Capitol Police just broke down. They didn't give the Capitol Police any guidance whatsoever. Those poor Capitol Police were on their own at every door. And that's why the Capitol Police leadership got fired later on. But some police let people in because they thought they could maybe de-escalate. Others decided to defend their doors, and that's where you see, you know, all these injuries. And there surely was injuries. You had police getting hit in the head with rocks, clubs, you name it. 140 cops were injured. And so, but I talked to some folks that are like, Don, didn't you see all the people walking in freely? I go, well, did you see the other doors where there was combat going on? Point, and I just think that we're in the society today where people see and talk about what they want to see and hear. Mm-hmm. But the fact is both of those stories were true. And to me, it's not hard to see that.
Well, yeah, I think that, like, I remember watching on the news as that was happening, and there's a degree to which it's difficult to tell how seriously to take something like that. It felt so unprecedented and shocking to watch it as it was going on. And, you know, honestly, I was thinking as I'm watching TV, is this the end of the United States as we knew it? And it was hard to gauge some of that. Was any of that going through your head, either for you or your peers in that moment?
No, I think no matter what, we were going to eventually certify the election. And so I don't think the future of our country was at stake. I mean, if it could, maybe it would have been delayed 3 or 4 hours. It was delayed 3 or 4 hours. Could have been delayed the next day. But we would have done the certification vote. The vice president was safe. And people say, no, he wasn't. Well, I go, no, he was. He had, I know the security guards, and they carried much more powerful weapons than a pistol. So they would have been, to get to the vice president, it just would not have happened with the security he had. And there was other security. That's why the one lady was shot. She was going through a window that was broken. And that was the last security line to some of the members of the House that were under the protection of the police. And the Capitol Police told the lady, do not go any further. I mean, this is the last line of defense. And they did take action. I think it was sort of remarkable there was not more injuries that day, frankly, or fatalities. Most of the police showed a lot of restraint, in my view. So, and you'll hear, too, from a lot of folks, how they don't understand the disparities between, say, what happened in Omaha in that summer and the sentencing, and then what happened in the Capitol after, you know, January 6th. And it's the difference between a county and city court system versus a federal court system. And if you dig into it, the federal courts are much more stringent. They have their rules are much more, more often than not, they don't do any bail, for example. You're in there for a long time, and you can request a speedy trial. Sometimes you don't want a speedy trial. And so there's just a different, people don't realize there's the difference between a federal legal system and a, say, Douglas County court system. It's a world of difference.
So that confidence that you mentioned that the election results would be certified, it does seem like it was more, it was harder to get there. It was harder for people to feel confident that that was what the outcome would be than it probably should have been or that it would have been before. And the debate over whether to certify it, taking so much of the energy, seems like something that's kind of a new development in our politics. What do you make of that? Why were you confident, and why do you think that's not something that everybody would have been confident about?
Well, it's really not healthy to question election results. So our country needs to be able to have confidence in the elections, and we call it election integrity. So the president made lots of accusations. Now there were, there's gray areas. So for example, we had multiple states who changed the laws because of COVID. And the legal argument on one side is that the Constitution says that it has to go through the legislatures, the state legislatures. And in some cases, it was mandated by the governors or sometimes by the courts, not the state legislatures. So the appeal was the changes like mail-in balloting rules and things like that didn't go through the prescribed legislature that is mandated in the Constitution. But we also have to point out we had states that did the same thing that went for President Trump. We didn't invalidate, those right. weren't brought into question though. I just think this is more complicated. A lot of people, on one hand it's more complicated, so they didn't call a question, say states that changed their rules but went for Trump.
Right.
But all of this did go through the courts, and the courts ruled in favor of letting those elections continue. At some point, once the courts rule and the Supreme Court rules, it's the, trusting the court system, you gotta move on. I mean, it's the law. It's like just believing in the law of the land. We're a nation of laws and legal processes. And once the Supreme Court rules, you have to respect it and move on. And so I think where I hear the most legitimate concerns is those states that changed the laws, but not in the way it was prescribed in the Constitution. But the courts looked at it and said, it's time to move on.
Yeah. I think what is disturbing about January 6th as a concept, as opposed to how much of a threat there actually was, is it shows that there's that threat of violence, if you don't like the way the system is going, is a real threat to, well, we have systems, we have to let them do their jobs, right? And so Do you worry that we're entering a more unstable political period? And January 6th was perhaps kind of a precursor to general, I don't want to say chaos exactly, but just more of a lack of faith in our systems?
I think it is a symptom of what we have going on right now. If you look at Congress, it used to be you had about a 20% of the Republicans were to the left of Democrats, and 20% of Democrats were to the right of some Republicans. In other words, you had this overlap. Today, there is no overlap at all. Now, there is, I call a broad center that knows we got to work together. But the fact is, both the Democrats and the Republicans have moved farther apart where there is no overlap. And there's some reasons for that. I mean, gerrymandering is part of that. I do think a lot of people listen to the cable news that they like. So they hear the news that they agree with, mm-hmm. not necessarily countering news. I think same thing on the websites, the media, social media, knows what you like and it sends you more of it. Mm-hmm. I clicked on shoes one day, I was still getting shoe ads all
sure.
the time, right?
Yeah.
Same thing with political reporting. And so I do think there is more polarization. And if I look at our threats today, I think Russia, China, Iran, cumulatively is a national security risk. China wants to be the world's hegemon over the next 20, 30 years. Right now they want to be the regional hegemon. And we have a lot of high stakes in Asia. But we have a hard time dealing with this threat when we have a $34 trillion deficit. We have things going on with our youth right now, like increases in depression and things like that. I think that it's a national security issue, right? We have a broken border. But we also have it's hard to deal with any of this when you have hyper-partisanship and not a willingness to find consensus. And I'm a student of our Constitution. I love reading the history. And our Constitution was built to force consensus making, and people don't know how to do it today. They want, you hear it all the time. We should demand 100%, we can force our way. I hear people on my side say we can force the Senate to do what we want and the president. It's never worked. And so the only way to make this work is take incremental steps forward, find areas we can agree on, but it's not very savory to both of the activists on the left or the right, right? And because it's, compromise and consensus building is not, I guess it's not very fulfilling, but that's the only way the system works. If we lived in a parliament, we could, and you're in the majority, you could get what you want. Mm-hmm. But we don't. We have three branches of government. One branch has a bicameral, and it's meant to force consensus and incremental movement.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Congressman Don Bacon about the issues on his mind as he runs for re-election in 2024. What do you think about Congressman Bacon's job representing Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District during his first several terms? Join the conversation on social media or call in with a brief voicemail to 402-881-0089, which we may play in one of our upcoming shows. That's interesting that you say that it's this idea that you can get what you want, because what I've sort of assessed when I look at some of the gridlock in Congress is that it does seem to benefit the minority party a lot of the time if you can make sure that the majority can't do something, or if you have the houses are ruled by different parties, that to an extent you can complain about, well, the guys in charge aren't doing anything, and then in that sense it can potentially benefit you to not help or to help make sure nothing actually gets done and then complain about how nothing's getting done. And so it seems like it's a little more complicated in the sense that it's almost easier to run when you're not in charge than to try to defend what's going on if the minority can sort of stop, or if collaboration is not broadly popular, because it's easier to do that negative polarization than it is to try
it's
to find a broad consensus.
It's easier to oppose than to govern.
Yeah, exactly.
In a govern, you're not going to get 100%. You're gonna have to get the maximize, optimize. But some folks don't know how to do that. I think you're right on that. But if you love our country, if I love my country, and I do, you got to sit down and figure out what's the most I can get with this group on border security. What is the most I can get on making healthcare more affordable? I mean, and you're not going to get everything you want. And that's exactly, James Madison built a system that protected the minority. So when you protect the minority, that means you got to find consensus. That's the result.
Have we given up on consensus?
Too many have. That's my take. So I figured out my first year in Congress in 2017, we were so proud. We passed record amounts of legislation out of the House. We bragged on it, how many bills we were passing. We were the most busy, effective House operation ever. but nothing, very little of it ever got signed out of the Senate, which means we really didn't get anything done.
Right.
And so I walked away in 2017 saying, well, that means we're going to have to find, we're going to have to write legislation with Democrats to get enough Democrats on board to get 60 Senate, you know. So that was my takeaway. You got to work with the Democrats to get enough bipartisan support that you can get 60 votes in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And so in 2018, I sort of shifted, you know, my operation style, and I've been in the part of the Problem Solvers ever since. And I've been part of two groups. The Problem Solvers are half Republican, half Democrat, and also the Four Country Caucus, which is half and half veterans, but with the same mission, finding areas that we can work together.
And so has that made a difference in terms of what actually gets passed in the Senate?
Yes, for starters, like the infrastructure bill, which I was part of even under the Trump administration. I believe it's a Republican value, infrastructure. Abraham Lincoln had the Transcontinental Railroad. Eisenhower had the interstate system. I believe in a strong infrastructure because it improves your commerce, your exports, public safety, and so forth. So I was an advocate for infrastructure under the Trump administration. Then we had 2020. I didn't change. I still thought we needed that. But it was really the Problem Solvers in the House that crafted 90% of that bill during the Biden administration. It was a lot smaller than what the Trump plan was. His was $2 trillion. Ours is $1.2 trillion. But we crafted about 90 to 95% of it. And the Senate liked what we did. And they said, hey, can you give us what you have so that we can massage it to get 60 votes? They ended up getting 66. Passed it, sent it back to the House. And then it became very partisan because the past president didn't want the current president to get any of the credit, even though it was really largely initiated by his administration, which it makes sense. I'm a patriot. I'm an American first. It shouldn't be about who gets credit. Is it good for our country or not? And I was part of the infrastructure bill from the get-go and the Problem Solvers. We were the team that made that possible, and I think we're benefiting from it today.
So as far as what you're talking about, the broad concern of why, you know, you need to sort of prioritize trying to work together, the Problem Solvers Caucus, I mean, when I think about the way that polarization has impacted, I think, people's lives and the way that a lot of people, especially younger people, I don't know that they really expect Congress to do a whole lot, right? They sort of expect the gridlock of different parties or parties that maybe don't have enough votes in the Senate to get anything done anyway. And so I wanted to pitch to you what I find, it's like an allegory or a metaphor that's fairly cynical that I sometimes am persuaded by, and I don't think you'll agree with, and I want you to talk me out of it. Does that sound reasonable?
We'll give it a shot.
Okay, all right. So so in this allegory, metaphor, whatever word we want to use, there's a big building, 100 people live in it. Only one person's in charge of making the general big decisions, and this person is democratically elected, but arbitrarily, we've sort of decided that only two factions are able to nominate this serious candidate. So 24 people pick candidate A, 23 pick candidate B. 50% of the people don't really participate that much in the process, or occasionally they do. So, okay, we have both candidates. They've agreed to hold a debate over what they see as the biggest issues. A dozen people show up to the debate. The building's also on fire, by the way. It's not immediately engulfing every room, but fires spread. This one will after enough time as well. And, you know, a couple people in that dozen, they're sort of smelling smoke, and they're asking, what can we do about this fire? Candidate A says, I think it's important we address it. If I'm elected, I'll put together a task force that will pick targeted areas of the building where certain tenants, they might be eligible to apply for a bucket of water. Candidate B says, I don't like this idea. You know, my opponent here, he wants to replace the drapes with pictures of ladies in underwear. And candidate A says, well, I've never said anything about that, but now that is what the debate is about. And so candidate A now is saying things like, look how repressive candidate B is, yada, yada, yada. Candidate B says, look how decadent my opponent is. We can't allow our drapes to degrade our society like this. And, you know, along the way, the dozen people now are arguing about the drapes, and the fire is slowly encroaching, and it's not looking good for their ability to get out of that building. And so when I look at the American system, sometimes I feel that way. On a bad day, that's what I see happening. I don't think you agree. What am I wrong about?
Actually, I think on bad days it is like that. Now we should be better than this.
Yeah.
But when you look at healthcare, the border, our deficit, our $34 trillion debt, I think what you described there is what's going on. We're all arguing, and it's a minority arguing over how to solve the debt or healthcare or the border, and we're making zero progress. Mm-hmm. But I would say out of your allegory that it's important to vote, because you're right. Right now, our voting participation is picking up. But you're right, 60% have been voting or so, and it used to be a lot less than that. So it's important to vote and be involved, because your voice really, really matters. And I would say we've had times where debates were substantive. I'm an Abraham Lincoln fan. He's my favorite president, probably my favorite person to study of all people, maybe outside of Jesus. Study him more. But Abraham Lincoln's the best leader we've ever had. If you look at those debates between him and Stephen Douglas, very profound. And we've had moments in our history where we had more substance in our debates. And I have to agree with you. The debates the last presidential race were terrible. I had to turn it off. And when you hear moms say they wouldn't let their kids listen to it, that's a shame. Well, but so I wouldn't. I think on a bad day, we're like what you're saying.
Well, so, but I think it's like it's a self-perpetuating cycle, because then those people mm-hmm. see sort of nothing actually happening. Maybe those people who aren't voting or who aren't engaged, it's easier to disengage when you don't necessarily yeah. feel like your vote will do more other than add to a polarized climate that's already not really addressing your big concerns.
Yeah. Well, we have an opportunity right now to speak more as statesmen, and that's what I'm going to be doing in this campaign. You're always going to have some partisan. I mean, I'm a conservative, and I was just going to things I'm going to point out about my opponent. But we need less Republican partisan and less Democrat partisan. We need more people trying to get above the fray and acknowledge the truth of our system. So, in all candor, James Madison designed a system that was hard to work. He made it to be hard. So what you're describing is what he intended in some ways. He wanted it to be hard, and he wanted more power at the state and local level. Okay, so that's why Article 1, Section 8, has very defined duties of Congress, and the intention was the states and the local governments would pick up more. And so I think we've tried to take on too much at the federal level, and we have an unwieldy government. It makes it very hard to be agile. The real intent here is to allow more power at the state and local level, and I think it's something that we're paying for right now. We've consolidated too much power at the top.
Is that actually a strategy, though, or are we just seeing kind of dysfunction, and is that like a rosy-colored way of describing the impact of the dysfunction, is that states have to do more now?
Well, that's the way it was intended. And so I think our founders wanted the states to have a bigger voice, and I think over time the federal government's encroached on what the states and the local government should be doing. And if you have a system of government written by our Constitution with Article 1, Article 2, Article 3, the way it's written, it was meant to be unwieldy, hard, and it was supposed to be like root canal surgery to get anything done. And it is, right? And so I think we probably put too much expectations and too much power at the federal level, that with separations of powers and checks and balances and a bicameral in one of the branches, James Madison made it to be hard. And we're seeing it. But he also, you know, him and Ben Franklin, John Adams, I go on and on, talked about our government has to be a government of moral people, which means I take it as people who aren't just into self-interest. They got to be above self-interest. It's got to be with the national interest. If we had more of that, we could do a lot more at the federal level. But it's hard to if you see hyper-partisanship. Hyper-partisanship creates gridlock. But if we could get above that, we get more done.
How do you get above gridlock?
Be example. I'll try to be. I mean, for 3 years straight, I was the number one bipartisan member of the House and Senate. This year, I'm number two. So number two of 535. So I went backward one. But think about that. I'm proud of that. For 3 years, I was number one of 535. And that's by the Common Ground Committee. And then there's another index called the Lugar Index. I think I was rated number 12. So, you know, both pretty good. I think we need more people that are willing to take risk instead of touting the party line, having your own moral compass. And I don't think you got to say this during the campaign. You can't just run this way and then say, okay, now I'm going to do this. But I've been running to be a voice of reason, pragmatic. I'm a conservative, but I want to get things done, and I know how the system works now. You got to work together and hit singles, trying to get grand slams all the time. It doesn't happen too often, but you can hit singles and doubles if you're a bipartisan. So I had the In the last Congress, I was number two of 435 for bills passed. I had 11 bills signed into law, not just passed out of the House, signed by law, which the number one guy was Congressman Neguse from Colorado. He had 12. And so, but they said, how were you number 11? Or how did you get 11 passed? It was because I'm more bipartisan and I can get support across the aisle and I'm hitting singles and doubles. And so the Center of Lawmaking Effectiveness, which is a joint program between University of Virginia and Vanderbilt, rated me the most effective Republican in the House, and mainly because of results like that.
So as far as trying to get things done, I mean, what are some of the things that what you've been able to get passed have addressed?
Most of it's more in the national security because that's my bread and butter. I know it. Mm-hmm. And so I work a lot on nuclear deterrence. I've worked a lot on electronic warfare programs. I'm in charge of the quality of life for the military right now. So I'm working on one out of eight military people are on SNAP or have to go to food banks. It's not right, for example. And our dorms and barracks have fallen behind. So I've done a lot of work in that area. I've done a lot of work on Gold Star families. We were leaving them behind a year or two after their spouse were killed in action. And they should have always been welcome to go on base and have access to the commissary and things like that. They should be part of our family forever, right? So that was my first bill, was giving more privileges to Gold Star families on base. I've also done cyber security. It's really clear who has cybersecurity at the military level, right? Who's in charge? But let's say that your radio station has a cyber attack. Does the military have any oversight of that? They really don't. So we have put clearly CISA in charge, which is under Homeland Security. And this is my bill. I want that leader to know that any attack on our private sector or infrastructure, you're in charge. Because everybody thought they had a piece, so nobody was in charge. As a military guy, if everybody thinks they're in charge or has a piece, nobody's in charge, and they're all pointing their finger. So I went to Homeland Security and CISA on my bill anyway, that was signed into law, says that of any type of cyber attack, you have responsibility for the defense and the recovery. So we had people like JBS were getting attacked and they were having to pay ransom. Well, that's unacceptable in our country, right? We had a pipeline attacked, right? And so a lot of these folks are coming from East Europe and Russia, some of them tied to the Russian intelligence and cyber, they dual hat. It's not fair for a company to think that they alone can stand up to the FSB cyber capabilities of Russia when they're working their crime networks. Now, you're going to have to give them more expertise here and help from our government. And so that's kind of legislation I passed. So that examples there are cyber security. I have passed a bill on fusion centers. Every state now has a fusion center with their state patrol, but you have elements of the FBI, maybe DEA, so like we have one in Lincoln, and they get access to all the intelligence that is coming out of Washington or what they're hearing from other states, and anything we're picking up here also goes into that network. So it's called a fusion center. That was my first bill, but what we found, 50 states were doing it 50 different ways. Some of the states even have their computers out of the box. They're just, so we built a standard for all 50 states. So this kind of legislation I passed, I'm much more national security oriented, obviously.
So the fusion centers, when you say that there's the 50 different approaches, is that an example of, would that be government that's not overreach, even though it's sort of trying to essentially nationalize something, or is it just providing a template, or what does that look like?
What we're trying to do is give the state law enforcement the latest data that the federal government's getting. Mm-hmm. So for example, we have intelligence that there's a human trafficking ring going through I-80, and they're putting up operations around the World Series. Well, say the federal government picks this up, they need to inform state authorities so we can do something about it. So that's just a case in point. So it's sharing data at the federal level to state. And if the state picks up, say they're sensing human trafficking of fentanyl going over I-80 going into Iowa, where they're going to share that data through their fusion center. And they had them before I came in, but they weren't functioning. You had maybe a handful of states that they were really invested in it, making it work. Other states, the people, they weren't even taking the computers out of the boxes. They didn't even have common software to communicate with each other. So my legislation standardized all 50 of the state's fusion centers so we could interoperate better.
I'm talking with Congressman Don Bacon about the issues on his mind as he runs for re-election in 2024. Stay tuned for the rest of the conversation after this break. And welcome back to Riverside Chats. I'm Tom Noblock. You can find the backlog of all of our episodes wherever you get podcasts, including our earlier conversation with Don Bacon. Today I'm talking with Congressman Bacon about the issues on his mind as he runs for re-election in 2024. Here's the rest of our conversation. Last time we talked, you went through your military experience to some extent, some of the lessons you took from that, which people can listen to if they want to go through our backlog. I'm curious now, as there are a lot of military debates happening or debates related to military intervention or support, and I wonder if you would say, has a sea change occurred in regard to the American citizens' interest in what the American military should be doing, whether directly or through support? Because I think about a certain cynicism that may be manifested from Iraq, Afghanistan, and maybe haunted by Vietnam to some extent. But it certainly seems like there is a more complicated response to what is the U.S.'s role in Ukraine and Israel than there maybe would have been at some point in the past. What do you think?
I was raised in the post-Vietnam era as a teenager, and there was, dark clouds. There was a lot of lack of confidence in the military. Ronald Reagan changed that. And then Desert Storm in 1991 totally changed it. And then our military was clearly the most effective fighting machine in the world. Now, I think coming out of Afghanistan and Iraq, there is now a renewed cynicism, and I think rightfully so, when should we put troops in harm's way? And I think that bar should be high. I mean, I would say I learned from that. I mean, we invaded Iraq when I was a lieutenant colonel, and Afghanistan when I was a lieutenant colonel as well. A brand new lieutenant colonel then. And I was probably more confident of victory, which we were victorious on the battlefield. It was the post-invasion, the winning the peace, where we were less effective, obviously. And I think those are lessons learned. And I think that bar should be high to put U.S. forces in harm's way. And I'm clearly much more cautious because of those experiences. I learned from them. However, we can't be isolationists. And I see some have overcorrected and they're isolationists where they don't want to send weapons to Ukraine. I think that's a mistake. Russia invaded a neighbor that wanted to be, that, first of all, Russia agreed to their independence in the 1990s, signed an agreement, took out the nuclear weapons out of Ukraine so they would respect the borders of Ukraine. But the Russian view and the Putin view is Ukraine is not, they're part of Russia. They call them little Russians is their term for them. But Ukrainians don't see that. They see themselves as a unique people with their own language, their own culture, history, and they've been abused throughout the centuries by the Russians. I mean, Stalin killed 4 million alone in the 1930s. A lot of people don't realize there was a civil war after World War II where Ukraine was trying to get their independence, but Stalin and Khrushchev beat them, in that civil war, trying to prevent Ukraine from becoming independent. So there's a long history of Ukraine wanting their independence. But we got to take Putin at his word. He says he wants to restore his old borders. Just like Hitler said in Mein Kampf, and you could listen to what other dictators have said they want to do, I think we should, what they say, they likely mean. And if Putin says he wants to restore his old borders, I think that would indicate pretty strongly Ukraine's not the last step. It's a first step. Further, he calls the Baltics renegade states, which indicates that he thinks the Baltics belong to Russia, just like China views that about Taiwan. And Baltic states, I'm the Baltic security chairman in the House. And these three countries are wonderful. They're small, but they've embraced our free market system, our rule of law, and they're very successful, but they're very vulnerable. They're right on the, they're with a small number of people, not a lot of depth, very at risk from Russia. If we don't stand up to Russia here and help Ukraine win by giving them the weapons they need, not troops, I think it's a green light for other invasions. And China's watching this in regard to Taiwan. And I think other countries are watching this, whether it's Iran or North Korea. And we, for about 10% of the cost of our DOD for 1 year, but this is over a two-year time frame, we have taken half the Russian tanks off the battlefield, 300,000 casualties of Russia. We have been extraordinarily efficient with the weapons we've given Ukraine, helping them maintain their independence, and they're being very successful on the battlefield. So we can't withdraw that. But a lot of people are saying that, or indicating we're putting troops there. We're not. We're not at war, but we're helping them defend themselves. So I'm an advocate for Ukraine. I'm also an advocate for supporting Israel. That's different than putting our troops in harm's way, and I see a difference.
Yeah, I guess what I see is the cynicism toward intervention seems to be – intervention in general seems to be something that at least a portion of the population has. And you'd mentioned that with Iraq and Afghanistan, it was – the what happened after, right, the aftermath of the invasions. Mm-hmm. But the cynicism surely is at least in part at the invasions themselves, right? People worry or wonder, was there any real justification for going there? And certainly in hindsight, it's easier to judge that, right, than it was in the...
I think there was easy justification. 9/11, okay. 2,977 people were killed on 9/11 by al-Qaeda, who was given safe haven by the Taliban. Now, the real question is, should we have had stayed there for 20 years? I mean, that's a good debate. Frankly, what President Biden did was reprehensible. We had 3,000 people in Afghanistan when he took over. We had taken zero combat losses in a year and a half, but we didn't have air power. We had air power that could provide precision weapon engagement within 15 minutes. So the Afghan military was doing the fighting, and we were giving them air power. We're also helping organize their logistics. But zero losses in a year and a half. Afghanistan forces held about 80% of Afghanistan. But the moment that Joe Biden pulled our air power and our ability to get weapons to the right spot with logistics, Afghanistan collapsed in about 2 weeks. And what makes me angry as hell was President Biden claimed that he had no dissent in his cabinet. And yet General Mattis and the CENTCOM four-star commander, both of them, 2 4 stars, in front of our hearing, and it was well publicized, said they advised against withdrawal of Afghanistan, that we had the right operation going, and that what we were going to do was going to lead to disaster, and they were overruled. And it really bothers me that the president claims there was no dissent, and 2 4 star generals said, well, they disagreed with the plan, but they were overruled, and it was a lawful order. We're still in Iraq with a very small number of forces, but they're being attacked every day by Iranian proxy forces, and that's a challenge.
So Donald Trump had run on getting out of Afghanistan, and I wonder how different was his plan than what Joe Biden enacted?
Well, I disagreed with his plan. In fact, I helped lead efforts. We passed a bill in the 2021 NDAA, but it was passed in the 2020 timeframe, that forbid him to remove any forces from Afghanistan unless certain preconditions were met. He vetoed it. He vetoed for another reason too, though. But this is one of the two reasons he vetoed it. We overruled the veto. We passed over 2/3 vote. I didn't like how he was negotiating with the Taliban only and not the Afghan government. That we saw that in Vietnam, where we were negotiating with North Vietnam without South Vietnam. It's wrong. So I was publicly against it. However, in the end, he did say that before we would withdraw, that certain conditions had to be met. And those conditions weren't met when Joe Biden withdrew. So I don't know that he would have actually done the withdrawal. In the end, Joe Biden gets the blame because he withdrew the forces. I don't know that President Trump would have actually withdrawn them, but I didn't agree with his agreement to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you're talking about Putin, and you compared sort of we can take him at his word the same way you could take Hitler at his word in Mein Kampf. And this idea of taking dictators at their words, it makes me think about what do you do with something like Donald Trump now has said a few variations of he doesn't want to be a dictator, but if he gets reelected, he will be on day one. And, you know, certain variations of like he has a lot of retribution that he wants to dole out immediately in a, I think, dictatorial fashion is the way it's being taken.
Well, you have a situation where a lot of the policies, I disagreed with the Afghan policy, but if you look at the totality, a lot of the policies I favored, maybe 80%, 90%, I don't know what that number is. And I think most of the country actually liked a lot of the policies. The temperament and the comportment is what hurt President Trump in 2020. And it hurt him in this district. We had 12% of the Republicans vote straight Republican, except for at the top of the ticket. And going door to door and making all these phone calls, it wasn't the policies, it was the, I'll just call it the temperament. And how we treat people and things like that. And so those kinds of statements backfire, and they hurt them. And so I don't understand why he can't learn that, because if he was had self-control, if he controlled what how he talked and treated people, he would be president today, in my view.
Well, some days he claims to be president today, right?
That's election integrity, and also respecting election results is very important.
Why is it that that was not seen as a line in the sand? I mean, he's doing very well in the Republican primary in a way that suggests that he might have more political capital now than he maybe ever had in the polls, right?
Yeah. Well, for one, President Biden, only about a third of the people want him to run again. Now, he's got a favorable rating around 40%, but almost two-thirds of Americans don't think he should run again. So it's also his opposition. And part of it is, and I don't think the White House figured this out, is that the average American has about 5% less spending power than when he started. Now, though, I'm glad that inflation's now back down to 2 to 3%, but that ignores the fact it went up cumulatively about 15 to 18%, and pay raises didn't keep up. And so people are still suffering. Thankfully, inflation's back, going back to normal, but the last 2 years of inflation is still hurting. But because of that, the border, Afghanistan, the current White House holder, he pulls the worst of any president going back to Truman right now, unfavorable ratings. That's Joe Biden. That's who President Trump's competing with right now. So it's going to be an interesting next 7, 8, 9 months.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Congressman Don Bacon about the issues on his mind as he runs for re-election in 2024. What do you think about Congressman Bacon's job representing Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District? What do you want him to know? What do you want him to think about in his next term if he should win? Join the conversation on social media or call in with a brief voicemail to 402-881-0089, which we may play in one of our upcoming shows. So to go back to my allegory for a minute here, when we have the idea of you've got the drapes, you've got the fire, I think you've identified several elements that you would say these are the fires we should be putting out, as opposed to arguing about the drapes. One that hasn't come up but is on the mind of a lot of people is climate change. And as last time we talked, I believe you had said basically that you do support kind of all of the above energy response. Is that still where you are on that issue?
Yes. For example, natural gas has been great for a cleaner environment. It still has carbon, but at such a lower level than coal. So that's an example where we're rich in natural gas, right? And so, but that's had a positive impact on the amount of carbon we put in the atmosphere. I think the interesting thing we have today that, since the last time we talked, the small modular nuclear power capability, the new technology is incredible. And we should be looking at this. You know, France is 95% nuclear. They don't have the energy crisis that Germany has because of the Germans decided to rely on Russia, right, for natural gas. Well, that was a problem after the invasion of Ukraine. France didn't do that. They went 95% nuclear. I think we should look at the same thing. Small modular nuclear power, I think, is the wave of the future. And the current technology, you can burn the nuclear waste and reuse it. So it's truly fully renewable. I also think natural gas and hydrogen is also areas that we can produce in our country and for cars and things like that. The strange thing for me is President Biden decided to go electric cars, that route. And we were very dependent on China for battery and a lot of this stuff, right? And we don't have the infrastructure. And you have to mine considerable amounts of the battery ingredients. But yet, you know, hydrogen and natural gas, we can do that in-house. And I see more potential. Now, I've talked to I'm not a car expert, but I've go talk to them, right? They think the optimal thing to do in the near term is hybrids. We could do all that internally, and it has a huge effect on, reducing pollution. And to me, I think there's a simpler plan than what the president has.
What do you make of the fact that Politico reported a few months ago that U.S. oil production is already at the highest in the world, and it's on track to set a new record in 2024? I believe you've been critical of the exact amount of oil being produced, but certainly I know energy independence is a phrase mm-hmm. that comes up a lot for you. What do you make of that fact?
Well, he did put a lot of limits early on, but remember how far gas prices skyrocketed. And I think what you're seeing is a response to what happened a year or two ago when prices were up $4 or $5 a gallon. And so I think he has corrected that and doing more drilling of domestic oil. Also, Canada has a big spot in that. But we should lead the world in production, in my view. But not just that, natural gas. Also, I'd like to say nuclear. There's, you know, 40% of Omaha's energy is wind. That's a good thing. I like it. Right. So I am all of the above approach. But early on, the administration did do a lot of executive orders that reduced oil production, or at least signaled to the market that they were going to do so. There's a difference whether you're actually reducing, but if you're signaling to the market that you're going to reduce production, prices are going to go up, and they did.
Well, so, I mean, I guess
they responded after that.
Sure. The question that's sort of under the sub question there, though, is in terms of carbon. If we're worried about climate projections, we're worried about what's happening to the environment, what the future will look like for kids, mm-hmm. grandkids. Oil seems counterintuitive to that, or to increase the amount of oil as opposed to try to decrease because we can compensate for it. Mm-hmm. Where do you land on that?
Well, I think it's pretty simple. Do you want Russian oil or American oil? There's right now a certain amount of oil you got to have. I'd rather use domestic. And by the way, we drill cleaner. We have a higher energy, you know, environmental standards. Same thing with our natural gas. Our natural gas is a lot cleaner than Europe's, or and particularly Russia's natural gas. So I think we should be doing this domestically, but we shouldn't be one-trick ponies, you know, drilling oil or natural gas. If I was president, I would be building a strategic plan for more nuclear power, and also I'd be looking at intermediate plan for more hybrid requirements because those work, and we have those resources in country. Why do I want to rely on China for battery ingredients? I don't. And by the way, when they mine, it's not very environmentally sound either.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think maybe it's more of an emotional question, though. I mean, when you think about the projections for the climate, when you think about the future 100 years from now, how worried do you get about what's happening as a result of what we're doing today?
Well, first of all, we can't do it all our own. I mean, we're one of the things that does bother me is some of the limitations we put on our own country, but yet Russia and China, like on the Paris Accords, there was a lot of things we had to do right now, but China could do in 20 years, and yet they're at a much higher output right now than we are for carbon, because they're much more heavily on coal and other dirty forms of energy production. But am I concerned? I just think my goal is to reduce pollution, and America has gone the right direction. Yeah, we have bent that curve over, but we can't just think we're doing it doesn't solve the problem. In my view. But one of the things I'm going to segue on you a little bit, we have to be careful how we present this to our youth. Because today we have a 30% increase in depression for high school kids. And we're seeing a significant increase in suicide attempts and things like that. So I was asking kids at like Westside, I do town halls, but mm-hmm. I enjoy it with high school. So what's going on? And I had a young man go, you know, why does it matter? I'm being told the earth's going to be destroyed in 20 years. And I don't believe that myself, right? But we have to be careful about this doomsday, what we're telling our youth, because I don't think it's working. And I think there are ways that America can lead by example. I've already mentioned how I would do it. But we got to push the rest of the world to take the same steps, because if we do it by ourselves, it don't matter.
So you don't worry about the next 20 years the same way? I mean, that kid has reason to worry, right? It's not just an emotional response to, like, things seem bad, the vibes are bad, right? There is science that suggests there are real problems that will have to be reckoned with.
And we're making progress. But to tell a 15-year-old kid that your Earth's going to be destroyed in 20 years, it's not smart. And what it's leading to, I mean, I'm not saying it's the only factor, but he said it was a factor. I asked, why is there depression and increase in suicide? And that was this guy's young man's answer. And, you know, and I was in a classroom or an auditorium of hundreds mm-hmm. of people in there. I just think we have to be a little more responsible in how we handle it. And I think America's doing the natural gas movement from coal to natural gas was a huge benefit to the environment. And if we go the nuclear route and hybrid cars, we can keep moving this forward. But we also got to realize if China is left off the hook, like they were done in the Chinese, or the, excuse me, the Paris Accords. You know, America can't do this on our own. So it's got, and it's got to be some equality in these agreements.
Sure.
We call it the Chinese Chamber of Commerce bill, because if you give them a 20-year delay, our businesses are going to move over there.
Sure. Although you have to, you know, if we're saying that it's overreach for like the federal government to tell a state how to do things, is it America's job to tell China how to do things?
I think we should work on it. Now, obviously, we can't make them do it.
Mm-hmm.
But if we do these things in isolation, we have to be honest. What is the real impact globally? Right? I mean, I think it's right to set the example. And I frankly think we'd benefit from having more the modular reactors. So there's would be benefits anyway. But if you're looking at it through the lens of strictly climate change, it has very little impact when America operates by itself. So we got to try to do this as a larger group.
How would we do that?
Well, I don't. I voted to support the Paris Accords, or not to walk away from them.
Mm-hmm.
But an agreement that says we're going to do things now, and China has decades to do the same, I don't think is right. So I disagreed with the Obama administration and now the Biden administration, who's allowed China to implement these things many years later.
Well, so we are running low on time. And as always, I try to get into deepish conversations to really sort of get under the surface. But there's only so much time and these are complicated issues. So for people who want to know more about your stances or to get involved in any way, where should they go?
On my official side, it's Rep. Don Bacon. That's on my website, my Twitter account. Of course, you call my office. We have some great interns working there. And on the political side, it's Don J. Bacon. Or at Don J. Bacon or www.donjbacon. And that takes us to the political side. And we'd love to have you. You know, we have typically 100 to 150 high school volunteers every cycle, the best in the country. In fact, I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the high school volunteers that have made huge impacts on our campaigns. They do door-to-door phone calls. They're in our parades. We organized in about 25 high schools. And it's one of the best ground campaigns in the country. And we love having young folks. The young folks that were in our campaign in 2016 are now running Senator Ricketts' campaign, Senator Fisher's campaign. A guy who is a senior in college 2 years ago or 3 years ago is now running my campaign. We had people running Governor Reynolds' campaign in Iowa, Senator Grassley's campaign, and almost all of the state Senate races right now have folks that came out of our campaign that are campaign chairman. And so we are a stepping stone for youth who like politics and want to be involved. I mean, we have a large family, but we get together. Our alumni is pretty big, and a lot of them are working campaigns all over the country. So I invite people to join us.
Well, I appreciate you coming on here to talk through things that are difficult to talk about. Thanks for being back here.
Thank you.
Riverside Chats is a production of KIOS 91.5 FM, Omaha Public Radio. The show is produced and edited by Courtney Bierman. Our original music is written and performed by The Real Zebos, and our artwork is done by Ben Matukowitz. Remember, you can find the backlog of all of these conversations wherever you get podcasts. Subscribe today, and please leave us a review. As always, thank you for listening. I'm Tom Noblock.